This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Good evening. This is this installment's title is Who's White? Part 3. I want to say a word about Stormfront, which I'm in the middle of reading an essay there about Who's White. Stormfront describes itself at its home page this way. We are a community of white nationalists. There are thousands of organizations promoting their interests or the interests, values, and heritage of non-whites. We promote ours. I wanted to mention that because that is very much what the White Network is about as well, although we're on a much smaller scale. So I have a lot of sympathy for what is coming out of Stormfront and the people who run Stormfront, and this message that I'm reading from here. So this is a piece that was spoken and written by John Law and is offered at Stormfront as a guideline, as part of their guidelines to posting there on their forums, their discussions. And I'll pick up where I left off last time, which was at this issue of when people come on and say that they're some part non-European descent. He writes, so in response to the question who's white, we answer, non-Jewish people of wholly European descent, no exceptions. What comprises European? Those areas north of the Mediterranean, west of the Urals, corresponding roughly to what was formerly known as European Christendom. I'll skip the next paragraph because I read that already. If someone were to say, he goes now into this business about holy. What do we mean by holy European descent? If someone were to say that they were 12.5% Amerindian, then as far as we're concerned, that's what they are, one-eighth non-white. This is something about which we can't compromise. You're either white or you aren't. After all, on an anonymous message board, we don't have the person-to-person contact that we do in the real world. We don't have the visual clues, the body language, the vocal expressions, the facial expressions, the overall impressions that we can get in real person-to-person meetings. In personal encounters, if someone looks white, sounds white, acts white, says they're white, then we can pretty much assume they're white. But on an anonymous message board, we don't have those visual and auditory cues. A poster can post a picture of anybody at all and claim to be that person, but unless we have met that poster in person, we don't know who they are. On an anonymous message board, all we have is what a poster writes, and if he writes that he is part non-white, then that's what he is, part non-white. I would say that in this situation, it's true what he says, that lacking those other clues, we can't say for sure, or we say less sure. But it does make us focus on the ideas that the person is expressing and the spirit that they offer those ideas in, the point of view from which they deliver their ideas. And that can actually be an advantage, because I think that in person-to-person meetings, you may some of that may focus may get lost when you're focusing on other things about the person. Law goes on, Dr. William Pierce had this to say about the matter. And here he's quoting Pierce. Who can say that he has no non-Aryan ancestry at all in his family tree? Not I. Most people can say who their parents and grandparents are. Only a few Americans can go back as far as four generations, however. I doubt that as many as 1% of Americans can go back six generations with any degree of certainty. Jews and liberals seize on this fact to confuse people with the claim that we're all mongrels, that there is no such thing as a pure race, etc. Therefore, it doesn't do any good to try and preserve the white race because it really doesn't exist. I'm sure that you're not fooled by that sophistry. We must be practical. We know that there is a white race and that it is easy to select individuals from that race who constitute a relatively pure subgroup. I'm not an expert on American ethnology, but I do know that the Indians consisted of many tribes which were racially distinct, ranging from essentially Caucasoid to essentially Mongoloid. So if one has Indian admixture, it depends a lot on what tribe. As a very rough rule, if a person looks white and thinks of himself as white and is the kind of person our other members wouldn't mind their sisters marrying, and if we know that he's no more than 1/16th non-white, we consider him white. As I said, that's a rough rule. A person may believe that one of his grandparents was an Indian because that grandparent lived on a reservation, but the fact is that many people who consider themselves Indians today live on reservations are more white than Indian due to earlier racial mixture between whites and Indians. There's a little bit of a dissonance here between what Pierce is talking about and what Law is arguing. Law is talking about online forums, and he's making that distinction, that specific application, whereas Pierce, I think, is talking more generally. It sounds even like he's maybe defending somebody in his organization that came out as partly Indian. I don't know for sure, but Pierce seems to be talking about in real life rather than for online, the purposes of online discussion, whereas Law seems to be arguing that we just need to cut off the nonsense before it even gets started, and I can definitely agree with that. That was our purpose in defining the white network as being for whites. We don't want the nonsense from non-whites coming in and trying to tell us how to think about things or what we're allowed to think about. Law continues here now after quoting Pierce. This type of question about being partly non-white is asked endlessly on Stormfront. Some posters are asking an honest question, but often others are anti-whites, desperately looking for ways to show that we are all mongrels and that there is no such thing as race, that miscegenation is good and natural, that we should all just go home and let things follow their course. They may start with an extreme claim of some minuscule admixture, say 1/64th, and then if we reject that for being non-white, they say that we are fanatics. And if we accept them and their claim, then we have started down the fatal slippery slope. If 1/64th is okay, they will ask, then is 1/32nd okay, or it must be okay too, since there's little difference. And if 1/32nd is okay, then 1/16th must be fine too, and so on down the slippery slope. Their agenda is to get us on that slippery slope, because that slippery slope ends with, quote, there's only one race, the human race, unquote. With that, the white race is defined out of existence. Even after these antis are refuted, they come back a few days later asking the same question as if there has been no prior resolution, in the hopes that they can snag a few newcomers and to plant the seeds of doubt. This continues on ad infinitum. I mentioned that that's what I think of it as well the last time I talked about this, that they're really just trying to sow doubt and cause confusion. And it's a recurring theme, too, in our enemy's tactics. Another tactic, Law continues, of the egalitarian crowd is to try and reduce the basis of white nationalism to something as absurd and as superficial as skin color. Our contention is that we are a distinct and unique people with our own culture, history, and destiny. We have not only the right but the moral duty to perpetuate ourselves. To do anything less would amount to racial suicide. We go to great lengths to preserve biodiversity, the spotted owls, snail darters, mountain gorillas, etc. Are white Europeans any less worthy of preservation? I'll inject here to say that skin color isn't really absurd or superficial. It's just one of the most obvious visual differences in race. What the egalitarian tactic is to polarize the idea of race into just black and white, and thereby they're trivializing it, reducing it to simple skin color. And in doing that, they're blotting out the myriad other ways in which various groups differ in a racial sense, not only in appearance, but also in their constitution, their bodily makeup, and their behavior, their intellectual, ideological makeup. Law continues, another post that appears endlessly on Stormfront is the kind that denounces various European people as not being truly white. In answer to that false accusation, the National Vanguard has stated that, and he's quoting a National Vanguard policy here, I suppose, Due to the generally deplorable understanding of race, it is necessary for us to emphasize that white people are the descendants of all historically European peoples, including the Irish, Slavs, Spaniards, Italians, Greeks, as well as the Germanic, Scandinavian, and Anglo-Saxon peoples, etc. So long as there is no discernible trace of non-white admixture. National Vanguard celebrates the cultural diversity of the white race. Our beautiful languages, traditions, and cultures are a strength. We are pan-European in our views and stand unconditionally opposed to conflicts between white peoples. Outside forces often exploit one white ethnicity against another. We do not excuse anti-white hatreds or historical scores and will consistently work toward reconciliation and unity in places where, such as the Balkans and Northern Ireland. Our watchword is no more brothers' wars. So there is this contradiction that they're getting at here. Between this idea that the egalitarians, the liberals, the anti-racists like to promote, this idea that we're all one race, the human race, and then at the same time they want us to celebrate diversity. So they're saying basically that we're all the same, but that we're diverse too, we're different too. It's a contradiction. And it's really a pretense. That's the explanation for the contradiction. They are pretending that we're all the same, and that facilitates mixing, which actually does nothing but create conflict, and it destroys true diversity, the differences between different groups of people. And John Locke concludes here by saying, so again, in response to the question who is white, we answer non-Jewish people of wholly European descent, no exceptions. And if you tell us you're not, we will believe you. I'm John Law, and thanks for listening. One of the things I'll just be a little critical here, but explain as well, I think, my view of it. One of the things that Law seems to be suggesting that seems a little silly is that white people or people can be considered white or not, depending entirely on whether they disclose their non-white admixture. And, you know, we can't forget the context here that he's talking about a situation where you can't tell for sure. It's somebody on the other end of the internet. And his goal here is to conduct and manage the discussion, pro-white discussion, on a pro-white forum. And so in order to cut off the nonsense, he's just saying that it's a good idea to take them at their word and just to end the argument, especially since it comes up over and over and over again. There's no need to have that argument again. But I think for strategic purposes, you know, beyond the tactics of an online forum, and in the real world, say in the membership for a nationalist organization or the citizenship in a nation state, that this same kind of exclusivity makes sense and for the same reasons. And in this case, we can better judge using the physical evidence that we have available to our eyes and ears. I'll also make the point that the technology exists today to define even less subjective boundaries between groups. We can get more objective answers via genetic analysis. And in the strictest example or case of this, a group or a polity could define itself. It has the ability to define itself in terms of a genetic profile, a cluster that you could imagine a set of genetic signatures of the founding peoples of that polity being recorded, and then membership is restricted to those that fall within a certain distance of that set of genetic signatures. It's and whether you can be admitted to the group or not could be based on a sort of group paternity test in a way, a DNA test that says, are you close enough to this profile? And it determines whether you're part of us or not. I'm going to talk about DNA in a whole separate segment, but that's coming. I'll say more about that. Pierce's rough rule that he talks about, this idea that the in-group or the people who you wouldn't mind your sister marrying, is, as he says, a practical device. It's a low-tech, intuitive, pragmatic solution to the problem. That if you don't happen to have a DNA laboratory at your disposal, you can use that. And I think that that's a good measure as well. I'll say a word too here about the fanaticism, the supposed fanaticism about or against mixing. Group biology is transitive, meaning what goes around comes around. So everyone who is part of us has an interest in who us is. Your taste in who you'd let your sister marry may not suit others. And that's what I mean by group biology being transitive. If you let someone into your family that other people don't agree with, well, ultimately, those differences, the more numerous they become, the more significant they are, the more likely the group will eventually cleave into factions, separate groups. And this is natural, and in some ways it's even unavoidable, as is the resistance to it, that people don't, you know, they don't want alien influences in their group. They don't want their group to be destroyed or washed away by being added to another group or having another group added to them. But this is just part of nature, and this is ultimately what leads to speciation. The case for group identity, I could make a case here, and I'm sure some anti would, that group identity should be based primarily or entirely on ideology rather than biology, that biology is bad, it's evil. And I've been over this before in some of the groundwork that I laid in earlier podcasts to talk about why biology is actually the driving force, or should be the driving force, behind group identity. The idea that group identity can be entirely based on ideology is a fantasy. It's a lie. It doesn't fit reality. And all you have to do is look at other biologically based identity groups to see that. So I'm going to talk now here in the second half about harkening back to a subject that I brought up in, I think, the first in this series of Who's White, and that is concerning the Aryans. There is more than just this linguistic evidence for Aryan history and heritage. It's bolstered by archaeological evidence that Vinson, whose piece I read back then, also mentioned slightly. And that archaeological evidence is basically cultural artifacts of the peoples, the Aryan peoples. And in recent decades, we have genetic evidence, too, that bolsters this image that we have, this narrative of who the Aryans were and how they migrated and what effect that had on Europeans. It turns out that there's this thing called the Kurgan hypothesis, and this is just another word, it seems to me, another term for Aryan history, and what I've talked about, what Vinson described. And I think he probably read the same thing that I stumbled into here. I'll provide the link in the page for this installment, but I'm going to read a little bit here about this. The Kurgan hypothesis, also theory or model, postulates that the people of an archaeological, quote, Kurgan culture, unquote, a term grouping the Yamna or Pitgrave culture and its predecessors, in the Pontic steppe were the most likely speakers of the Proto-Indo-European language. The term is derived from Kurgan, a Turkic loanword in Russian for a tumulus or burial mound. The Kurgan model is the most widely accepted scenario of Indo-European origin. So as I say, this is probably just another term for this Aryan history that Vinson related that I read to you all. And it's the cultural artifacts that are cited in this article about the Kurgan hypothesis are burial customs and the mounds that they used particularly, but also the article cites chariot use and how that spread out in concentric circles in the same way that the Aryan homeland map that I put on that part one of the post described it. There's a term called Ur-Heimat, which is related to this concept. The idea is that this Kurgan hypothesis is one Ur-Heimat hypothesis. And Ur-Heimat, it's a German compound word, Ur meaning primitive or original, and Heimat meaning home or homeland. So it's Ur-Heimat just means, it's a fancy way of saying ancient homeland. There's this term Old Europe I mentioned previously, and I'll read a little bit about that, too. Old Europe is a term coined by archaeologist How do you pronounce her name again? Maria Galumbas? Is that it? Darn, I said... Yeah, here it is. Gimbutas. Maria Gimbutas. To describe what she perceives as a relatively homogenous and widespread pre-Indo-European Neolithic culture in Europe. In other words, the Stone Age people that were in Europe before the Indo-Europeans or Aryans invaded. And she bases this particularly on Malta and the Balkans, that they were, I guess, evidence that she found there. Gimbutas and her associates regard the terms Neolithic Europe, Old Europe, and pre-Indo-European as synonymous. According to Gimbutas' version of the Kurgan hypothesis, Old Europe was invaded and destroyed by horse-riding pastoral nomads from the Pontic-Caspian steppe, the Kurgan culture, who brought with them violence, patriarchy, and Indo-European languages. More recent proponents of the Kurgan hypothesis agree that the cultures of Old Europe spoke pre-Indo-European languages, but include a less dramatic transition with a prolonged migration of Proto-Indo-European speakers after Old Europe's collapse because of other factors. So this Kurgan hypothesis and what Gimbutas is describing here is really two peoples coming together, and Vincent alluded to this. He called them white people as well, that the old European peoples were just another branch of white that had settled in Europe previously, and that the Indo-Europeans invaded afterward. And some of this is an emphasis of that and the different character of the peoples, the different cultures that they had, the different attitudes that they have. So let me read a little bit here about Maria Gimbutas, which describes a little bit of this. Gimbutas was a Lithuanian-American archaeologist known for her research into the Neolithic and Bronze Age cultures of Old Europe, a term she introduced, and for her Kurgan hypothesis, the current most widely accepted of the Proto-European Ur-Heimat hypotheses among scholars. Gimbutas' conclusions that Neolithic sites in Lithuania and across Europe pointed to a long-term stable egalitarian societies with women at the center, materially and spiritually, earned a mixed reception by other scholars, but became a keystone of the matriarchal studies movement and the goddess movement. I'm not sure I like the sound of that, but okay, let's just take it for what it is there, and maybe I can dig into this a little more in the future. This is the first I've heard of this. I never knew anything about this until I ran into this week. The article continues a little further on. In 1956, Gimbutas introduced her Kurgan hypothesis, which combined archaeological study of the distinctive Kurgan burial mounds with linguistics to unravel some problems in the study of Proto-Indo-European speaking peoples, whom she dubbed the Kurgans, I guess to avoid calling them the Aryans, the name of which had fallen out of politically correct favor. Namely, to account for their origin and to trace their migrations into Europe. This hypothesis and the act of bridging the disciplines has had significant impact on Indo-European studies. I suppose before Gimbutas that where exactly the Aryans came from or the Proto-Indo-European speakers lived was more in question, and she helped nail that down, I guess, using archaeological evidence. Gimbutas gained fame and notoriety with her last three books, The Goddess of the Gods of Old Europe in 1974, The Language of the Goddess in 1989, which inspired an exhibition in Wiesbaden in 1993 and 94, and her final book, The Civilization of the Goddess, published in 1991, which, based on her documented archaeological findings, presented an overview of her conclusions about Neolithic cultures across Europe, housing patterns, social structure, art, religion, and the nature of literacy. The Civilization of the Goddess articulated what Gimbutas saw as the differences, and this is key here, this part, the differences between the old European system, which she considered goddess and woman-centered, gynocentric, and the Bronze Age Indo-European patriarchal or androcratic culture, which supplanted it. According to her interpretations, gynocentric or matristic societies were peaceful. They honored homosexuals, and they espoused economic equality. The androcratic or male-dominated Kurgan peoples, on the other hand, invaded Europe and imposed upon its natives the hierarchical rule of male warriors. Here's a cleavage between these two peoples, and with qualifications here that, of course, Kin Buddhist doesn't know for sure. It's a theory that she's pieced together bits and pieces of evidence to support, and that there's debate about it still. But it seems pretty clear that there's a culture clash, a culture war, even within the European peoples themselves, between these older Stone Age peoples and the Indo-Europeans who invaded afterwards. And Kin Buddhist draws this, and I can see why she must have been able to do this, to talk about Aryan history, was that, you know, she disguised it as feminist history, I guess. But I think that there's probably some truth to this, and that this struggle between white men and white women, which my partner Carolyn Yeager has been focusing on quite a bit lately, this could be the roots of it here. It's fascinating to me, this information. And it's not the kind of stuff that, even though you can find articles on it in on Wikipedia, it isn't what's focused on in school. And let me make one last point here in response to some criticism a friend sent to me. And he was criticizing my reading of the Aryan linguistics piece in part one, and said basically that it ignores some global history and there's contamination from other sister proto-languages, and how can we be sure? And he forwarded me an article from a contemporary online news magazine or science news magazine type website titled Every Human Language Evolved from, quote, a Single Prehistoric African Mother Tongue, unquote. And he didn't elaborate on what his purpose was in forwarding that, but reading the article, I can see that this is the PC description of history. This is what we're fed in school, what our kids are fed in school, is this out-of-Africa theory. Everything is about that, and it's focused on what happened 70,000 years ago, because even that article makes it clear that the offshoot of people that became white people ultimately and settled in Europe, both the Indo-Europeans and the old Europeans, left Africa 70,000 years ago, even by the out-of-Africa theory, which has its own controversy swirling about it. And why should I care about people that my ancestors left behind 70,000 years ago any more than I care about the Aryan history, which happened only 5,000 to 6,000 years ago? That's far closer in time and ancestry, and it's much more relevant to white people. This is what we should be learning about. This is what we should be teaching our children, not this out of Africa stuff. That's in the far distant, dim past.